needs a vacation? Today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Saudi Arabia wants to be a tourist destination, but some reputations are hard to shake.
It's been a rather difficult country to visit.
Also, Canada's Prime Minister faces scandal and shrinking support. We'll explain what happened to the once glowing image of Justin Trudeau. And a Syrian man describes how war has affected the children in his hometown.
For me, they have more knowledge than any other kids that I have met because they've witnessed a war.
Plus, the world of tennis is debating fairness in the status of transgender athletes.
Look, I love men's tennis and I love women's tennis, but they're not necessarily the same thing.
Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Saudi Arabia has been getting a lot of negative press lately. The murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi back in October continues to hang over the kingdom's reputation. And then came the arrests of women's rights activists and the story of Rahaf Mohammed, the young Saudi woman who fled her abusive family. All this doesn't make a strong case to visit Saudi Arabia for fun. But the kingdom wants you to come, like on a vacation. Seriously, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman himself has said he wants the kingdom to be a tourist magnet, and he's unveiled projects that include theme parks, cinemas, and a futuristic city run by robots. Will it work? The World's Shirin Jafari reports from Saudi Arabia.
The beach isn't exactly the image that pops into mind when you think of Saudi Arabia. But hop on a plane and fly 2 hours west of the capital, Riyadh, and you're in Jeddah, a port city on the Red Sea. At the heart of Jeddah is what locals call the Al-Balad, or the town. Picture narrow cobblestone alleys, old houses with wooden shutters, and carts passing by carrying heaps of red tomatoes. This is where I meet Kamal, a young, giggly guy who shows tourists around in Jeddah.
Inshallah, I hope so.
He's in a white robe, tan vest, and a traditional hat that's kind of like a turban. We start off in the old town, trailed by my ever-present government minder. The Saudi government assigns minders to all foreign journalists to make sure we don't report on anything too sensitive.
Right now we are in front of Nasif's house, one of the biggest houses.
Kamal was born in the old town. His family has been here for generations. So this work is personal to him. He's a software engineer, but he does this on the side.
You know, a lot of people, when they finish their job, they stay at home or they go with their friends and gather. I live in here. When I finish my job, I just come in here. For me, like, maybe...
In timeless fashion, the faithful make their way to Mecca from all over the Muslim world.
Jeddah has always drawn tourists. It's a gateway to two of Islam's holiest sites, Mecca and Medina. So Muslims have to come here for pilgrimage. Traders and pilgrims from all around the globe have descended on this town. They used to come on ships, and they brought with them their food, culture, and languages. That's why you find a Chinatown here. Dumplings are a favorite street food. And for a long time, the Saudi government was satisfied with the money it made from religious tourism. And it had a ton of oil revenue. That was enough.
I mean, historically, Saudi Arabia has been a relatively isolated country.
Kristen Dewan is with the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington, D.C.
I mean, of course, it's quite connected to the global economy. But in terms of being welcoming to have people come in to sort of visit, it's been a rather difficult country to visit.
Segregation of men and women in public, a ban on alcohol, strict rules on how women dress, all that didn't exactly scream summer vacation to most visitors. But now the Saudi government wants tourists to come. It knows it can't rely on oil revenues forever. So cue ads like this one, featuring super friendly locals in sun-drenched locations. Think of it as the Saudi version of a sandals resort ad. Just replace the bikinis and shorts with long robes. No couples cuddling and no margaritas.
And so I think they had been doing a lot in the last couple of years to try to present a different image about Saudi Arabia, one that is more youthful and more open and engaging.
Even the colors.
Yeah. Each one of them wants
Kamal,
to
be the 20-something tour guide, proudly explains that the Saudis have managed to get several of their historic sites on the UNESCO World Heritage List. They've also been working to make it easier for foreigners to get tourist visas. The government has promised scholarships to Saudis looking to study tourism. And I'm thinking, that's nice and all, but can Saudi Arabia really attract tourists when it has such an abysmal human rights record? Would people look past the murder and dismemberment of Jamal Khashoggi? I can't ask Kamal. The minder is right there. But a few minutes later, I get a rare chance.
I have my time chair in Orlando.
We come across a group of men sitting in a circle, enjoying their afternoon tea. Among them is Salem Al-Qureshi, a 72-year-old retired civil servant. He says he lived in Miami for a few years, so did his four sons.
They get their bachelor degrees from there.
Al-Qureshi says he comes here with his friends every day. So what do you guys talk about, I ask.
Everything.
The U.S. government shutdown, Trump's wall, Saudi politics. Ugh. I look around. The minder is a few feet away, so I take a chance. I mumble, what do you think about what happened to Jamal Khashoggi?
To whom?
To Khashoggi.
Why you are talking about Khashoggi? Why? It's a small problem.
The way Al-Qureshi sees it, the Khashoggi case was played up by Saudi's rivals, Turkey and Qatar. Does he think visitors will come?
There is a problem all over the world. But we are better than the others, really.
I wanted to ask him more about Khashoggi, but the minder is heading our way. So instead, I nervously thank him and move on.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts.
Kristen Dewan of the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington, D.C., thinks the recent events are a real problem for the kingdom.
Both the killing of Jamal Khashoggi and also the arrest and alleged torture of women activists, that completely runs counter to the new image that they were trying to project.
At the same time, she says, Saudi Arabia's reputation as a place where tourists don't go might actually work in their favor.
The selling point for Saudi Arabia will be that it's a new site and that it will bring in some of those people that are curious to see a country that hasn't been visited as much and to see new sites that haven't been developed.
For now, Dewan thinks the government's target is Saudis themselves. Many go on vacation abroad, and the government wants them to spend that money here at home. As we walk along, I spot a group of Chinese visitors. They're the only tourists I've seen so far.
This is the gate of Medina. If you have any questions.
Kamal is optimistic. He says tourists will come. And when they do, he says, he'll be here to show them around.
I hope you enjoy the tour right now.
For The World, Shirin Jafari, Jeddah.
Next week, Shirin's reporting on Saudi Arabia's changing culture continues with a look at how one woman is trying to normalize cycling for women in public.
For sports like cycling, you need to have a brave heart for the first time. You just have to go brave it and do it.
That's next week here on the show. And you can find all of Shirin's stories at theworld.org. One of the Catholic Church's most senior cardinals and one of the four men who organized this week's Vatican Summit on Clergy Sexual Abuse has admitted that he could have handled abuse allegations brought to him better and faster. Oswald Gracias, the Archbishop of Mumbai in India, spoke following a BBC investigation. It revealed claims he did not handle allegations of sexual abuse appropriately and in one case of alleged child abuse did not alert the police. Priyanka Patak reports.
Archbishop Gracias is one of Asia's most prominent Catholics and some believe could be the next pope. But we've been told of a culture of silence facing victims reporting abuse in Mumbai's Catholic community. Our investigation found that in two cases, the Archbishop did not promptly or properly investigate claims of abuse. The story begins here in Mumbai in 2015, when the parents of an allegedly raped child were desperately trying to reach senior church officials.
He said the priest has done things to me.
After 2 days of calling his office, they were granted a brief meeting. I meet the parents in an empty chapel, surrounded by their faith, as a mother weeps.
I told him everything that the priest had done to my child. I said my child is in a lot of pain. I came to him with great expectation of hope and justice. But he said, I don't have time. I have to go to Rome.
At the meeting, the cardinal said it seemed to be a police matter. Under Indian law, any allegation of a sexual offence against a child has to be reported to the police. But he never personally made the call, and neither did anyone from the church. Instead, the priest was arrested 2 days later after the parents sought medical attention and went to the police themselves. He is now on trial. After putting our investigation's findings to him, the cardinal agreed to an interview. We meet at his ornate residence, the same place as where the parents say they begged him for help.
My first concern was, I was a bit shocked. This is a serious matter. We might have to go to the police. And I told the priest, I'm suspending you. Please go away.
Would you think that it was a mistake to not alert the police yourself?
You know, I'm being honest, not 100% sure. Perhaps I must reflect on that. I admit whether immediately the police should have got to be informed, sure.
The cardinal said he rang from Rome the day after meeting and was told by his bishop that the family had already informed the police. That night, the family say they asked for medical help, something the cardinal strenuously denies.
I mean, I'm really ashamed if we did not give medical aid if she wanted it. We give everybody medical aid, and not to give a child who said he was abused by a priest would be indefensible for me. I mean, inconceivable. But on the other hand, I don't remember them having asked. Without doubt would have given them that.
We wanted to know if more could have been done. A priest, whose identity we are disguising, told us he had warned Cardinal Gracias between 2013 and 2014.
I told them that there are strong rumours about this priest. And then the Cardinal told me directly that he is not aware of anything. We have realized that quite often when things are reported, nothing seems to be happening. In fact, you are marked.
The cardinal says he cannot recall the conversation. He says he did not recollect any cloud of suspicion over the priest. But there is another case dating back almost a decade. In 2009, the cardinal met with a woman who said she was raped by a priest. He says the church did investigate, but it was only in late 2011 and the involvement of women's rights lawyers that the priest was removed from his parish. The cardinal says it was a complicated case which was slowed by appeals and protestations by supporters of the priest, but the church should have moved faster. Cardinal Gracias did say that the church should always listen to victims and should make reporting easier.
I hope there are not predators. I mean, I hope. I don't know, I won't say. And there's a culture of silence all over Asia. Now, this should not prevent us from taking any steps to prevent such acts.
On Friday, the cardinal will lead the conference on a session about accountability in the church. But at home, many will question the culture of silence and difficulties victims have faced in reporting sexual abuse in his own diocese.
The BBC's Priyanka Pathak, reporting from Mumbai. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Justin Trudeau is having a bad week, a really bad week. It may seem surprising considering the image that Canada's prime minister has cultivated, that of a sensitive, earnest, progressive leader. This week, though, Justin Trudeau is the man at the center of a scandal involving possible government influence on a legal case. To get us up to speed, our own expert on all things Canadian, the world's resident Canadian, Andrea Crossan, joins me.
Hey, Carol.
Andrea. Oh, Canada. What is going on?
Carol, this is a very Canadian type of scandal that we're talking about. There's no adult film stars involved or Roger Stone type characters. But there are some pretty shocking allegations and there have been some high profile government resignations. None of this is looking good for Prime Minister Trudeau.
So no Mueller probe, but what's the scandal?
It involves an engineering and construction company called SNC-Lavalin. They are based in Montreal and Quebec. They are an engineering and construction firm. The company employs about 28,000 people worldwide in about 100 countries. Now, the deal is that the company has been dogged with corruption allegations. Tens of millions of dollars in mysterious payments surfaced, supposedly used to bribe the Libyan government for project contracts. And a corruption and fraud case was brought against SNC-Lavalin, and it's been reported that the Canadian government, specifically the Prime Minister's office, may have tried to lower the charges against the company.
Why would they do that?
So if they were to let the company off with the equivalent of a plea bargain, it would allow them to evade trial or criminal conviction, because if the company was convicted, it would not be able to compete for Canadian government contracts for a decade, which would be a massive hit to the company and loss of jobs.
So are you saying that SNC is like a Canadian version of too big to fail?
Yes, in Canadian terms, this is a massive corporation and, yes, too big to fail.
So how does this impact Trudeau?
Well, it's led to a number of high-profile resignations, the most high-profile being his former Attorney General, Jody Wilson-Raybould.
That sounds like a big deal.
Well, yeah, see, the thing is, it's been reported that Trudeau's aides attempted to press or influence Wilson-Raybould into intervening in this case and that she refused to cooperate. Then the Prime Minister moved her out of that job in a cabinet shuffle, and then she resigned.
Ouch.
Prime Minister Trudeau has denied any impropriety. He's had to address this issue a number of times, and here's how he initially addressed it, which was a full denial.
Neither the current nor the previous Attorney General was ever directed by me or by anyone in my office to take a decision in this matter.
But it seems as though his story changed.
It was her responsibility to come forward to me this past fall and highlight that directly to me. She did not.
So now he's kind of turning it back on her.
Yeah, he kind of threw her under the bus at that point. But he's made a follow-up statement to that.
Jody Wilson-Raybould asked me if I was directing her or going to direct her to take a particular decision. And I, of course, said no.
So where does that leave things?
Jody Wilson-Raybould has refused to speak about specifically what she was asked by the Prime Minister if she was asked something regarding this case. However, she did choose to say this in Canadian Parliament yesterday.
I understand fully that Canadians want to know the truth and want transparency. Privilege and confidentiality are not mine to waive, and I hope that I have the opportunity to speak my truth.
Well, sounds like she has something to say, but she has to wait.
I can't imagine that is a truth that will reflect well on the Prime Minister.
So what's the real fallout here? I mean, could this take down Justin Trudeau?
Well, not right now, I guess is the best way to put it. Yesterday, members of Parliament voted against a motion to launch an inquiry into the allegations against the Prime Minister's office. So there's not going to be a government investigation. But none of this is looking good for Justin Trudeau in terms of his popularity within Canada. His approval numbers are plummeting. There are a number of issues that could concern voters, but this may be a tipping point for him. And one important thing to remember, Carol, is that this is an election year in Canada. Justin Trudeau is up for re-election in October. So, you know, the larger question of does this eventually take him down? Canadian voters will decide.
The world's one-woman Canada desk, Andrea Crossan. Thanks, Andrea.
You're welcome, Carol.
In Istanbul, Turkey today, lawyers staged a protest in support of press freedom. That's after a Turkish appeals court upheld prison sentences for 14 staffers of a newspaper, a paper that's routinely critical of the government. The Committee to Protect Journalists says at least 68 journalists are imprisoned in Turkey, more than in any other country. Duri Buskarin reports for The World.
3 years after a violent coup attempt, Recep Tayyip Erdogan's government continues its campaign to quash dissenting voices. Now, political parties are gearing up for local elections at the end of March, and tensions are even higher than normal. About 100 lawyers gathered in Istanbul today to protest an appeal court's decision to imprison 14 employees of Cumhuriyet, one of Turkey's last newspapers that features perspectives critical of the ruling party. A role under Liu of Reporters Without Borders says he was shocked at how easily journalists could be convicted.
Let's remind two people that this decision was taken anonymously and without any details, without any distinction between defendants. So it was quite, from the beginning, it was quite politically motivated.
Reporters, office staff, even the paper's accountant were accused of supporting Kurdish separatists and the coup's plotters by influencing public opinion. The defendants denied all charges. An estimated 75,000 people have been arrested since the attempted coup in 2016. That's when a faction of Turkey's military tried to overthrow Erdogan's government overnight. More than 200 people were killed in the aftermath and more than 1,000 wounded. Turkey has blamed the followers of a U.S.-based cleric, Fethullah Gulen, and the hunt to prosecute his supposed supporters has been relentless.
This is not a democracy.
Attorney Tora Pekin says those with sentences of more than 5 years can appeal their convictions. The rest will serve the remainder of their sentences in prison.
This is an unfair decision. The first decision and now the upper court decisions, are both of them are totally unfair and against human rights, against press freedom, against all the rules that I know.
The staffers at Cumhuriyet have been able to return home while they wait on their appeals. After hearing the news, Cumhuriyet Ombudsman Gray Oz posted to Twitter, "Thankfully, I made the last corrections to my novel," he wrote. "We won't be seeing each other for a while. Goodbye." For The World, I'm Duri Buscarin in Istanbul.
I'm Carol Hills. ISIS recruited Westerners to come join its ranks as foreign fighters, and now some of those people regret it. Should they be allowed to go back home?
Reintegration of people that went on to become foreign fighters with ISIS can sometimes be the most credible voices in deterring others.
That's just ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. When an American flees to join the so-called Islamic State, should they be allowed to come home? Hoda Mathana left Alabama to join ISIS in Syria. Now, after the collapse of the extremist group's stronghold in Syria, she's in a refugee camp and wants to return home. President Trump tweeted she will not be allowed to come back. He said she was never a U.S. citizen to begin with, though her family and lawyer maintain she is. Jesse Morton is a former jihadist recruiter. He served time in jail, but he was allowed to return to the U.S. Now he runs the group Parallel Networks to rehabilitate other radicalized individuals. Jesse, what do you think of Hoda Muthana's case? Should she be allowed to come back to Alabama?
I do actually believe that she should be allowed to return to the state. I think this is actually an opportunity to prove that rehabilitation and reintegration of people that went on to become foreign fighters with ISIS can sometimes be the most credible voices in deterring others. If she was able to return to the states and receive the proper intervention services she's in need of, she, in fact, could become a voice sort of similar to the one that I have become.
What year was this that you became radicalized and got involved?
So it was, radicalization is a process. It's not an event. I converted in 2000, early 2000, and I think that the onset of my radicalization came with 9/11, like many others. But by 2003, I was a serious, committed preacher.
And your Muslim name was Yunus Abdullah Mohammed. You create Revolution Muslim. You're actively recruiting people. And your turnaround, your rejection of radical Islam, it didn't come on your own. You were arrested in 2011 in Morocco and brought back and convicted and spent time in prison. Persuade Americans why you should have been given a second chance.
Well, I had actually ran from threatening the writers of South Park to Morocco, and while I was there, the Arab Spring.
Let me interrupt you right there. Let me interrupt you right there, because our listeners might not know that you had threatened the writers of the TV show South Park because you thought they were anti-Islam.
Well, they portrayed the Prophet Muhammad. They really didn't, and it would require some explanation. But an individual affiliated with my website did post threats, clear direct threats to them, and then he got arrested trying to travel to Somalia to join Al Qaeda's outfit there. So I ran knowing I would soon be arrested. But what happened when I went to Morocco was very important for us to understand what needs to occur here in this situation of these female cases that are coming up now, because when I got to Morocco, the Arab Spring broke out. But the most important thing was that I was extracted from the network. I no longer had day-to-day contact, and the social psychological forces that kept me going in regard to my extremism were removed. But really, my transition came in contact with an empathetic FBI agent who eradicated the black and white worldview that they were waging a war against Islam. I went on to turn and to become an informant and to cooperate with the government. And since that time, I've been working to repair some of the damage that I caused.
And you received a reduced prison sentence because of that cooperation, didn't you?
I did, yes.
Let's go back to Ahoda Muthana. Do you think she should face jail time, too?
Absolutely, 100%. And it should be a very lengthy sentence. I mean, the degree to which she acted is severe. However, there are mechanisms for rehabilitating her inside of prison, and it's a very good opportunity for us to learn more about that. This is a female case where the roles that females play inside of jihadist movements actually decrease the risk for violence, and she won't have access in a federal prison to disseminate radical ideas.
In what way do they decrease the likelihood of violence?
For women roles?
Yes.
So women play a very different role. They're not allowed by the verdicts or the fatwa of jihadist scholars to carry out attacks unless they're in a situation where they're in defense, like if they're living in Raqqa and there's people approaching that are enemies of Islam, so to say. So the role that women play is as mothers, right? You can see with regard to the children that have been born under ISIS and in the refugee camps. But they're also chief radicalizers and propagandists. The message that women send is that men are weak and they're not acting. Look at me, I'm acting on behalf of the cause.
There have been multiple cases of women involved in extremist Islamic terror attacks. I mean, one that comes to mind is Tashfeen Malik, the woman in the husband and wife team who carried out the attack in December 2015 in San Bernardino. So it seems like women do take part in these attacks.
It is true that you do have young people that are living on the periphery, like the case of Tashfeen Malik, who certainly did not coincide with what ISIS would have considered permissible. And that is the case.
I think what's tough in these cases, there's also the case of the British woman, Shamima Begum. Neither of them sound terribly remorseful, to be brutally honest. I mean, the comments they're making are comments because they're suddenly in a very tough spot, particularly the case
Absolutely.
Of Shamima Begum. I mean, there's not a lot of kind of, you know, this was awful what I did, this is terrible. The expressions coming across are, I really want to be forgiven. I really want to become a part of, you know, either the UK or the US. I'm not scary. But it seems to be statements based on the predicament they're in now. How do you persuade either Britons or Americans that these individuals should be welcomed back or brought back, even to face due process?
Well, they shouldn't be welcomed back, and they should be treated as essentially enemies of the United States, which in fact they are. We do have to understand that they suffer, like anyone else that's been in a war zone, from the trauma of war, and they've been heavily indoctrinated. But they were indoctrinated before they left, but that's even worse now. That's not the concern here. The concern is risk for the American public. Do they pose a risk to commit an act of violence, or is there any risk that they could, let's say, escape or anything like this? There is zero risk that that's the case. These are women. They might have very radical ideas, but still, it's an opportunity if we look at it in the right light. I know that that sounds a bit off-base, but the fact that these women are not going to pose a risk for violence, that they will receive an incredibly long prison term, and the fact that, yes, they are continue to support an ideology that is heinous, they won't have an opportunity to express that ideology any longer. The benefits here outweigh the harms.
Jesse Morton is a former jihadist recruiter. He now runs the group called Parallel Networks, aimed at rehabilitating other radicalized individuals. The British woman we just mentioned, Shamima Begum, isn't likely to return to the UK at this point. The government there has revoked her British passport. Here's Begum speaking to the BBC this week. She was answering a question about whether she was sorry for those killed by Islamic extremists.
I do feel that it's wrong that innocent people did get killed, like women and children. Just like people, you know, like the women and children in Barghouz that are being killed right now, unjustly, by the bombings. It's a two-way thing, really.
Paul Stott researches terrorism and security with the Henry Jackson Society in the UK. He says Begum's words haven't gone down well there.
I think there was real shock and anger at some of the things she was saying, some of the positions she still seemed to be justifying with regards to Islamic State. And what the British Home Secretary has done in stripping her of her British citizenship is something that's now increasingly common in the UK. It's something that's legal. And in this case, probably appears justifiable. You have to remember, commentators like myself haven't necessarily seen all the evidence that's gone across the Home Secretary's desk. So he's taking a decision based on intelligence, and presumably that intelligence is very damaging.
When Shamima Begum asks for the UK to forgive her, is it genuine? I mean, can we trust what she's saying at all?
Well, I'm not particularly sure she has asked for forgiveness. Her comments have been particularly curious, really, because they've been a sort of strange mixture of some criticism of Islamic State, for example, for being corrupt, but also that she seems to have been disappointed in Islamic State, that it didn't meet her high standards. And, you know, it's a bit like listening to somebody who's been very committed to an ideology and who's been slightly let down by others and who doesn't necessarily criticize or reject that ideology.
I wondered, do you get the sense that Shamima Begum thinks that she did anything wrong?
I get the sense most of all that she's disappointed at how things have turned out, but she seems quite happy on a personal level. She's met her husband, a jihadist fighter, through Islamic State. Her regrets seem to be, in a way, around separation from some of her family in the UK and regret that she doesn't have access to welfare provision, the National Health Service, to help her children. So I don't think there's any clear evidence that she realises that she's done some very bad things, and also that she's played a part in other people's oppression. She's gone out to another country and joined an organisation, Islamic State, that was repressing others, has arguably committed genocide against the Yazidis, terrible crimes against Christians in that community. She doesn't seem to have any regrets about that.
Could the counterterrorism and intelligence community make use of someone like Shamima Begum in a way that could help fight the whole effort against ISIS?
I think there's certainly a case for taking individuals back who've provided actionable intelligence and who've clearly changed their minds and who may be of use potentially in counter-radicalization programs. There's no evidence, though, in this case. And indeed, when you listen to her, some of it's a sort of me, me, me type argument. And then other parts of it seem to be that she's still committed to Islamist ideology, still committed to the idea of an Islamic State. She's just not totally happy with how Islamic State themselves have delivered on their promise.
Paul Stott researches terrorism and security with the Henry Jackson Society in the United Kingdom. Thanks a lot for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Syria's war and the battle against ISIS have been anything but simple for activists like Abdulaziz al-Hamza. When Syria's anti-government uprising began in 2011, al-Hamza was a college student. He started attending protests in his hometown of Raqqa, like this one. He recorded the protests on his phone and uploaded the videos online. That caught the government's attention, and al-Hamza was arrested and tortured. Then ISIS gained the upper hand in Raqqa. Al-Hamza remembers the first time he ran into an Islamic State recruiter.
A masked man with a Saudi accent entered my university. So he came to us and tried to convince us to join ISIS. He managed to convince one of my friends. Later that year, my friend was dead.
So al-Hamza and his friends took to Raqqa's streets again, this time risking their lives to shout, ISIS should leave. ISIS fighters came to al-Hamza's house looking for him in 2014, so he fled to Turkey. He's lived in exile ever since. Finally, this week, he could celebrate the news that ISIS was being forced out of its last strongholds.
Many witnesses have seen cars entering the last town, evacuating ISIS fighters. Like, finally, there is no ISIS in Syria.
Are ISIS fighters actually being allowed safe exits from these last strongholds?
Yes, they were able just to pass through. And right now the question is, what's going to happen with those ISIS fighters who've been evacuated in Syria?
But if the ISIS fighters are allowed to go, won't they simply take ISIS somewhere else in Syria?
Of course. If you would look at the social media, at different platforms, you would find ISIS supporters using the crimes that have been committed by the United States, by other countries. They use photos and videos to recruit more people, to say, look, the entire world is trying to fight Islam. So I think they would figure out a way to come back again.
You've been an activist for democracy in Syria for a long time now. And you and so many others took to the streets in 2011 to really try to bring democracy to Syria and fight for political rights. Do you feel betrayed at all?
Yes, of course. Early when the protest started, when it was like a peaceful protest, the international community was just giving promises, promising Syrian people that they will be helped. For years, the Syrian regime was killing over 1 million Syrians. The international community did nothing. But when ISIS showed up, the international community came together. They started to attack ISIS, which I agree about. But at the same time, they forget about the Syrian regime.
Looking back, has it been worth it?
For me, yes, it's worth it because we were living in a country where we had no education. And right now, as Syrian people, I would meet many kids who are like 12, 13, 14. For me, they have more knowledge than any other kids that I have met because they've witnessed a war. So in other countries, they should have been seeing a therapist or whatever. But right now, I feel like our kids can be politicians right now. They can be teachers. They can.
Because they've learned a lot.
Yeah. So that was a good thing for us as people to know, to develop a huge amount of knowledge in a short time.
You're Syrian, but you left a number of years ago. You've lived in Turkey. You lived in Germany. You're now in New York. Do you feel like you have a home?
I feel like homeless sometimes. I feel like that I have to move all the time, change my location, change my number. But at the same time, I have a voice and I was able to deliver the message of many Syrian people to the international community. So again, many people, they haven't heard about Syria. So I feel so important for me at the same time being homeless with no home to deliver a message and educate people about what's going on in Syria and to hear from someone who's been there, who witnessed all those groups.
Abdulaziz Alhamza is a Syrian. He's the founder of Raqqa is Being Slaughtered Silently, a group that exposes the atrocities committed by ISIS and others in Syria. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
This week, tennis legend Martina Navratilova kicked up the debate with some controversial comments. She said it's cheating when transgender women compete in women's sports. The criticism has been swift, but some are defending Navratilova. The world's Alison Herrera has the story.
Martina Navratilova first shared her opinion on transgender athletes on Twitter and followed that up with an editorial in the British newspaper The Sunday Times. She wrote, "A man can decide to be female, take hormones, win everything, and earn a small fortune, then reverse his decision and go back to making babies if he so desires." She wrote, "It's insane and it's cheating." Since then, the LGBT advocacy organization Athlete Ally has cut ties with Navratilova, calling her transphobic. And many activists and international athletes say Navratilova's argument doesn't hold up, including Dr. Rachel McKinnon. She's a Canadian world champion cyclist who advocates for the rights of trans athletes like herself.
Her core argument is to exclude real, innocent trans women on the basis of a non-existent, made-up, bare possibility case of a fraudster. And that is not how we do ethics. That is not how we do human rights.
McKinnon accused Navratilova of having an irrational fear of trans people.
She has portrayed it as me attacking and bullying her, which is not the case. Like, you can go look at every tweet I sent. And it was explaining, like, things like genitals don't play sports. Why do you think that matters?
On Twitter, Navratilova has responded by saying the criticism is unfair and that this is a serious issue that warrants discussion. Sports writer and tennis player Stephanie Miles agrees. There should be a discussion. On the website Tennis Life, she wrote that what Navratilova is saying has some merit.
The fact is, and look, I love men's tennis and I love women's tennis, but they're not necessarily
the same thing. The men, you know, most of them are taller and most of them have more upper body strength. And that's just sort of the way it is. And as a result, they can serve a lot harder.
The Women's Tennis Association, the sport's global governing body, has rules in place when it comes to trans women athletes. 10 nanomoles of testosterone per liter of blood. That level must be maintained for at least a year before competition. In 2016, the International Olympic Committee adopted the same guidelines for transgender women athletes, though transgender men can compete without restriction. Miles says rules are good, but, she says, transgender women still have an advantage because men often have more muscle.
Even though your testosterone level might have dropped, now maybe you might not be as powerful as you were previously, but that doesn't mean that you wouldn't be a lot more powerful than a woman.
But Dr. Rachel McKinnon, the Canadian cyclist, doesn't buy it. She says it's absurd to think that men would temporarily transition just so they could enter and win a sporting competition. She says that's not how transitioning works.
So in the States, to legally change your gender or your name requires a court visit. And you have to find a judge that will look at you and hear your case and grant it. These requests get denied by actual trans people who are not faking it.
And she says it takes a long time to find a doctor to administer hormones, and it's an expensive process. The International Olympic Committee hasn't weighed in on Navratilova's comments. So far, no transgender athlete has competed in an Olympic sport. For The World, I'm Allison Herrera.
And finally today, toilet paper. Americans use a lot of it.
3 rolls a week per person, more than any other country in the world.
Shelley Vineyard is an activist with the Natural Resources Defense Council. She co-authored a report released this week titled The Issue with Tissue, How Americans Are Flushing Forests Down the Toilet.
The issue is mostly that the major toilet paper manufacturers in the United States do not provide toilet paper brands that are made with recycled content. If you go to the supermarket, you won't see brands like Charmin made with recycled content. They're made entirely of virgin forest fiber.
And where does that come from?
Well, much of the tissue coming from major toilet paper and tissue manufacturers in the United States comes from the Canadian boreal. And the Canadian boreal is the world's largest remaining intact forest, and it's disappearing before our eyes at a rate of 7 NHL hockey rinks a minute because of destructive logging.
Wow. And is most of the cutting of that boreal forest, is it for toilet paper?
Well, toilet paper is one of the sources. The America actually purchases the most boreal wood products. And so it is just unbelievable that in today's day and age, a throwaway product like toilet paper is destroying some of the world's most important forests.
And are those big toilet paper companies, are they in the process of offering a truly recycled brand of toilet paper?
We've asked Procter & Gamble, who makes Charmin, to make their product more sustainable by including recycled content, and they've refused so far.
What?
We
Why?
Hope that'll change.
Why? What are the reasons?
Well, major toilet paper manufacturers like Procter & Gamble will say that consumers simply don't want toilet paper made with recycled content. But that ignores the fact that many consumers simply have no idea the environmental costs their toilet paper choices have. And what we're asking today with our report is that major toilet paper manufacturers make sure that products are truly sustainable so that when you go to the supermarket, you can feel confident that you're buying a product that's both good for our forests and quality.
Shelley Vineyard is with the nonprofit environmental advocacy group, the Natural Resources Defense Council. She co-authored the report, The Issue with Tissue. Thanks, Shirley.
Thanks.
We reached out to Procter & Gamble for comment, but did not hear back by airtime. Before we go, here's a preview for our show tomorrow. We'll be taking a look at where we stand now with the Mueller investigation. It's been almost 2 years since the special counsel started looking at links between the Trump campaign and Russia, and there's speculation that Mueller might be wrapping up his investigation as early as next week. President Trump insists there was no collusion, but even after Mueller's probe is complete, there will still be a lot of unanswered questions.
is Congress's job to then take what has occurred over the previous 2 years, sift through it, present this to the American public through the form of public hearings and an investigation in the House, and then decide what to do about it.
What have we learned from Robert Mueller so far, and what comes next? That's tomorrow here on The World. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for tuning in.
PRI, Public Radio International.